We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Show. This episode is a recording from KNVC 95.1 Carson Community Media in Carson City, Nevada. If you want to hear this live, tune in at noon Pacific time on Fridays, and you can call in with your questions, you can send tweets, and you can interact with the show in real time. For now, you'll hear me ask to call in, but of course, don't call in because this is a recording. Now onto the show. You're listening to The Archaeology Show with Chris Webster on KNVC 95.1 FM Carson Community Media in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. Welcome to the show. Hello, listeners and fans of archaeology. I'm your host for the next hour, Chris Webster. I'm a contract archaeologist in the field we call cultural resources management. I also run the Archaeology Podcast Network. We have a lot of shows about archaeology, and you can find them all at www.archpodnet.com. Today, I'm talking with archaeologist Dr. Amanda Harvey. We'll get to her in just a second. However, first and foremost, this is a call-in show. Call in with your questions to 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to @ArchaeoWebby, @ArchEOWEBBY, or @ArchPodNet. Call in with your questions about archaeology, history, archaeology you saw on TV, questions about finding things in your property, anything. We don't have all the answers, but you've got two archaeologists here that kind of know some things about archaeology, so we'll try to point you in the right direction if we don't know the answers. So anyway, that's 775-515-4141. All right. As I mentioned, my guest today is Dr. Amanda Harvey. Amanda, how's it going?
I'm well today. Thank you, Chris. How are you?
Good, good. So you live here in Carson City, so you're down here in the studio with us, which is great. So thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. So first, we'll get into your career as an archaeologist, but tell us a little bit about yourself right now. Where are you from? You know, what brought you here?
I was born and raised on the coast of Alabama.
Yeah.
And went to school down in Alabama and in the South in general for most of my career, and then eventually got into the PhD program at the University of Nevada, Reno, and said, hey, I'm going to move to the Southwest. And my advisor's like, no, this is the Great Basin. I was like, well, where is Reno? And then I just up and packed up my little Forester that I bought because my Camry wouldn't make it out to Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been out here for the last 7 years.
Nice. Very big difference between Alabama archaeology and Great Basin archaeology.
Mountains. I don't have to dig little holes every 50 meters anymore.
That's right. That's right. I started my career on the Southeast digging holes, and my wife and I basically moved out here because we didn't want to dig holes anymore. So
I concur.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talked about that before on this radio show and on the podcast. If you're not sure what we're talking about, you think archaeologists dig all the time, don't they? But not when the geology doesn't support that. So, you know, we do pedestrian survey out here, and that's mostly what we do. So, and which means no holes, just
everything's
looking
on the surface.
Everything's on the surface. That's right. So, how did you get interested in archaeology? When did you first become aware of archaeology as a thing?
It wasn't until college that I actually became aware of archaeology. I went to Auburn University, War Eagle, and got in to do aerospace engineering.
Nice.
Yeah. I was really interested in flights and planes and NASA and space.
Yeah.
And then I had to take a core anthropology class. It was a required class. And I was blown away that you could actually study humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, changed my major immediately and decided that I was done with math after calculus and and then focused on anthropology. And I had an archaeology professor, the late Dr. John Cottier, who I told that I wanted to be a forensic anthropologist. And he said, absolutely not. You will not be. You'll be an archaeologist. Here's my lab. And so he put me to work in his lab. And that's sort of where it all started at Auburn with Dr. John Cottier.
Wow. Do you know how many people I've asked what their sort of origin story is? And you're the first one I've heard that's anywhere close to mine, because I was a commercial aviation major,
mm-hmm.
got my pilot's license, my instrument commercial ratings. Well, most of the work towards those anyway, didn't actually get the ratings because of the way that school worked, and then switched to anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, what?
What? Exactly. They're like, wait, you went for aerospace engineering
yeah.
because I was really good at math and science yeah. and not that good at writing and yeah. English and all of the yeah. things that you do in anthropology, lots of. And so once I found that challenge in anthropology, I was like, oh, absolutely. This, mm-hmm. is, this is for me. I yeah. don't want to build spaceships anymore.
Although you're uniquely suited, and I'm always hoping I get the call too, to like be that xenoarchaeologist that they say, hey, we found something weird on Mars. Can you go?
Sign me up. Right? I am so there. So
I know. I know. They talk about space archaeology, but really most of the space archaeologists right now are really just looking at satellite photos mm-hmm. and historical data to try to map these sites. I know someone mapped the moon landing site.
Yes.
And I've talked to Alice Gorman on like one of the very first episodes of the Sierra Mark podcast. I interviewed her. And she's out of Australia. She's done a lot of work with that kind of stuff. And it's very interesting. But I want to actually be a space archaeologist.
Yes, like go into space. Astronaut / archaeologist.
That's right. Astro-archaeologist.
Ooh, I like it.
Let's call it that. All right. Nice, nice. All right. So now you're out here in Nevada. What are you doing nowadays?
Nowadays, I work for a cultural resources management firm, an environmental consulting firm out of the Bay Area called mm-hmm. Garcia & Associates. Doing CRM in California and Nevada.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you, now you're out here, I mean, your job, you're able to work remotely for a lot of stuff.
I do. Yeah. I work from home. I have the dream archaeologist job. Actually, I have my home office
yeah.
and I do everything from there. And then I go into the field mostly in California right now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably once a week, every other week or so, but mm-hmm. then I come back and spend most of my time sitting at a computer because I do the fancy stuff of paperwork.
Very nice. Very nice. So what interests you the most? This is kind of a weird question, but what interests you the most about, say, CRM archaeology? Because you, a lot of times in this field, when you hear somebody having a PhD, you don't hear about someone having a PhD. I mean, unless they work for, say, Far Western or something like mm-hmm. that, which is stacked with PhDs. But a lot of times in cultural resource management, and it's not because you don't a PhD is not beneficial. It's just that most people stop at a master's degree because it's usually all the higher you need to go. But you have a PhD. What are you doing in CRM versus working at a university somewhere? What attracts you to this field versus, say, that? Unless you're thinking about going the professor route someday.
I initially got into a PhD program because I wanted to be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy teaching, but I don't enjoy the university system.
Absolutely.
It is not in the best state right now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put myself into that position.
Right.
So I've always done CRM during the summers to basically, you know, pay for life when I'm not in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided once I graduated, we were actually abroad. And once we came back, I decided to go into CRM. For me, I really enjoy being able to mitigate what happens to the site. It's some type of control issue, I guess you would call it. but having some type of control over what level of respect and protect the sites get, and if they're mitigated to, you know, are we going to excavate these and just let this development actually happen? Or do we need to actually protect this site because of its value to our history in general?
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoy doing the environmental compliance of it all, which yeah. is kind of strange. But the legal aspect of it is really interesting to me as well.
Mm-hmm.
How can I legally protect sites, and what means can I have with the law to tell you, no, you can't do that?
Yeah. Okay. What is your day-to-day look like? What are some of your responsibilities with the CRM firm?
Day-to-day. So I am a senior archaeologist with GANDA is our colloquial acronym.
Yeah.
And so right now I have a couple of projects that I am managing. One is the San Francisco City Planning is doing some seismic upgrading to mm-hmm. some health centers in the Mission and Castro districts. And so we're doing some monitoring plans for that.
I imagine someone in San Francisco is always doing seismic upgrading.
Oh, absolutely. It is never ending in the yeah. city, actually. And the city is very interesting because of how many layers of history
oh, yeah.
has been there and how many cultures are within these layers as well. So there's always something new in San Francisco happening. We have a couple of projects in San Anselmo. So most of my stuff's in the Bay Area doing bridge replacement work.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of on-call stuff with PG&E.
Cool.
And so my day-to-day is really client management, report writing,
yeah.
monitoring plans, making sure my field techs are good and have all the information they need, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
working with some of my other coworkers to collaboratively come up with our reports and make sure that we're hitting all the little notches we need to.
Yeah, absolutely. So mostly project management, principal investigator type stuff.
Project management.
Okay. You know, that's something people don't think about a lot with archaeology. They're like, oh, I'm going to grab a whip and go into temples and stuff. But no, there's a lot of sitting behind a desk and doing paperwork.
I sit behind a desk and do paperwork 40 to 50 hours a week.
Nice.
Once you get the PhD, you become the paper pusher.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing. You might get a little more money, but you're not out in the field as much as you used to be.
Absolutely not.
And that's one of the downsides for anybody. For anybody listening to this on the podcast, mostly is, you know, I talk to so many people that are like, oh, I want to make more money in CRM and make my own choices and stuff like that. So I'm gonna go get my master's degree or their PhD, usually a master's degree. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you're relegating your life to a life behind a desk, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's where you're going to be once you get that. You know, maybe Absolutely. Not right away, but at some point. So, the struggle is real when it comes to that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you don't like sitting inside all day long and writing those papers, don't get your PhD and go to CRM.
No. And if you get that advanced degree and you think, I'm going to start my own company, because that's what I did. And I mean, not because I got my master's, it's just I wanted to go down another road. But that's also not an easy route to take, because then you're doing everything for a little while, you know, because most people don't get to the point where they're operating multiple offices with a staff and things like that. It just doesn't happen. You know, it's not very common. So, I mean, we just took a really serious negative turn on this, but I would say stay a field tech as long as your back and your knees hold out.
Yeah, as long as your knees hold out. And nowadays when I go into the field, I have to preface the techs that come with me. It's like, I'm old, I'm broken,
right.
My knees don't work, and I'm slow. So bear with me. I'll make it there, but I'm slow.
Right. Exactly. Which, you know, out here in Nevada, we have the most... the statistic I heard one time, and I never actually verified this, but it seems right when you look at the maps, is that we have the most unnamed and named mountain ranges of any state in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's just up, down, all these little valleys. My God, every time you got to go out and do survey, you're just climbing straight up these hills. It's ridiculous.
I do a lot of work in the Sierras.
Yeah.
It is just up, down.
Yep. So before we started, when you came in today, you made sure I wasn't going to ask you the question, what's the coolest thing you've ever found? And I don't ask that question. And people often ask you and I that as archaeologists, right? That's the one thing they ask. And the one thing I want to ask you before I get to this question is really about stories, because this is one of the things I like to do on a radio show and the podcast is educate and tell people how to interact with archaeologists in history in a way that we'd appreciate mm-hmm. as archaeologists. And one of the ways to ask that question, because you always want to hear about the coolest things we found, right? But I try to promote that it's not about the artifacts. The artifacts are a piece to the puzzle. If you ask somebody that was building a puzzle, you wouldn't ask them about a specific piece laying on the table. You would say, what's the overall picture look like? And they'll show you the box, right? What are you building? Well, with archaeology sites, we're building a history of a particular location or event, or in the larger context, a bigger picture of the people that were coming in that area. So of all the sites that you've been on and worked with, whether in this country or not, what is probably the one story that you helped contribute to that sticks out in your mind the most?
Oh, man. So the story. I did my master's in Mississippi at the University of Southern Mississippi mm-hmm. Under Marie Danforth. And she is a physical anthropologist or a biological anthropologist and does a lot of excavations of human remains.
Okay.
And one of the big projects I did with her was for a site called the Moran site. It's on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in Biloxi, Mississippi, about 100 yards from the shore. And so it was actually a salvage operation to begin with when Hurricane Katrina came through. Mm-hmm. There were known individuals underneath a art studio called the Moran Studio.
Wow.
With the Moran family. It's a big family down in Mississippi. And so Hurricane Katrina comes through and completely levels the house. This is before that they had a skeleton on display in their house over with plexiglass and cherry shellac over it. But that's a whole other thing. So Katrina knocks down the house and we actually get to excavate finally because we know that there are burials underneath there. And they started it right before I came to Southern Miss. And I think they did a small excavation in 2007, and I joined them in 2008 as I was finishing my undergraduate. And then in 2009, I started at Southern. And by 2012, it was the final excavation of this site. And we ended up excavating 32 individuals, and they actually dated to the 1770s.
Okay.
Which turns out they were some of the first people to actually land on the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
Wow.
During the, there are two French Canadian explorers who came down and kind of colonized the coast, mm-hmm. Bienville and D'Iberville. And they created my hometown of Mobile, and they also created New Orleans. So first they went to Mobile, created the colony there, and the crown wanted them to go west to find the mouth of the Mississippi. And demanded that they stop in the Biloxi Ocean Springs area, but they didn't really want to. Mm-hmm. And so they stopped there because they're taking directions from the crown, bring in some people, but they never set up any type of permanent structure, agricultural fields, or anything that would make this colony actually last. And so eventually everyone died. pretty rapidly, actually.
Yeah.
And so these guys were some of the first people to actually be buried there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course, Bienville and Iberville, they decided, hey, we're going to go over to New Orleans, and founded New Orleans shortly after that. But these guys had some, they were basically kind of French criminals that they shipped over to populate the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
And they had some really neat disease because my professor studies paleopathology, so the study of ancient diseases.
Yeah.
And so we had a guy with clipophile, and we had a couple of guys.
Clipophile?
Yes. It's a, I think that's how, it's a... something, a disease that alters your spinal column.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then there were some people that were buried face down and someone buried without a head and a couple other things. Someone with a crucifix, and it was just a really neat way to be able to understand the history of the Gulf Coast and who were the first people there beyond just what the textbooks actually told us.
Okay. Now you mentioned they didn't, in that particular location, set up any structures or establish anything right there. Mm-hmm. How do you guys know that? Do you have journals or diary entries, things like that?
Yeah, we actually went through the shipping logs.
Oh, okay.
I have a degree in French as well.
Nice.
And so I got to scroll through lots of shipping logs to see actually what was shipped over.
Mm-hmm.
We had no evidence, historical documentation of any housing structures or anything like that. And we also know that they were taking and shipping people up the Mississippi to farm the agricultural lands of the Delta, which the Mississippi Delta, for a lot of people don't realize, it's up in the northwest corner of Mississippi.
Hmm.
It's not along the coast. And so you get on the Mississippi on a ship and you go all the way up.
Yeah.
And so that's where they were sending people. They weren't staying on the Gulf Coast. And so they're also... I think there were historical documents of D'Iberville and Bienville kind of saying they're not really into the Mississippi coast, that they would rather go on towards the mouth of the Mississippi because, you know, it's maybe Biloxi Ocean Springs is kind of in between Mobile and New Orleans. So they're all maybe 50 to 100 miles apart, not even that. You know, it's like Reno to South Lake.
Yeah, yeah. I always think, too, about those guys coming from different places in Europe. And, I mean, especially like France. You know, the weather in France is very different than it is in Mississippi and on the Gulf Coast. And, you know, they've got clothing that is designed for that, you know, the environment in France, which is probably a little bit cooler, to be honest, a little less humid,
just a wee bit less humid.
Yeah. Probably fewer bugs, mosquitoes, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's just, man, they come there and I'm not surprised they don't stick around long sometimes or don't like it or speak about it favorably.
I mean, I'm not a fan of the weather or the bugs down south.
No.
I had an archaeologist friend come out and visit me a couple of years ago in October in Reno. And the first thing she said, she's like, oh my goodness, there are no bugs.
Right.
And then the next morning she woke up and be like, there are no bugs. I'm like, no.
No.
No, it's really nice and pleasant in Reno.
Yeah. My wife and I just bought a little townhouse in Reno near a place called Virginia Lake. But the backs of this little quadrant of townhouses, there's a little pond back there. And you hear frogs and stuff at night. And we actually just bought a little table for our deck with the propane fire that comes out in the middle of it. So we've been sitting out there, and we're still, we've been here 10 years now, and we're still amazed that we can just sit out there in the evening and there's literally no bugs. There's an actual pond 10 feet away, which would normally spawn all the mosquitoes and things, but there's just nothing. Yeah.
Yes.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Well, this conversation, our listeners may not realize, is related to archaeology, because some of the things that drive our careers is getting away from stuff like that. The briars in the southeast, the bugs.
Oh, man. Yeah. And then I decided, you know, after working in the southeast for a minute and in the Mississippi Delta area and in the woods of Alabama, that the mosquitoes were okay, but not big enough that I didn't go work in the Belizean jungle to where you have like clouds of mosquitoes following you. Just packs. Each person had their own pack of mosquitoes. And then they had bat flies. So, you know, that just adds a layer of awesomeness to the mosquitoes.
Well, let's dig into that in a second. First, let's take a second to pop out and say, if you've got any questions for Amanda or myself or anything about archaeology, 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to at Archeowebby, A-R-C-H-E-O-W-E-B-B-Y, or at ArcPodNet. You know, you can send me an email, Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. I can't guarantee I will see that on this call right now or on this show, but I will answer it and possibly talk about it on a future show or a future episode of the podcast. Again, the podcast is over at arcpodnet.com/archaeology, but we got a lot of stuff over there. If you're listening to this in real time on the radio or on our Listen Live link, we actually have a new show starting on the Archaeology Podcast Network called A Life in Ruins. I want to say CRM archaeologist, but one of them is getting his PhD, so he's moving on to different things, actually. And it's the three guys that are doing a really great show, and that's arcpodnet.com/ruins. The show debuts on Monday. So, Monday, May 13th. All right, so you mentioned Belize. What the heck brought you to Belize from, you know, the southeast to Belize?
I wanted to be a Mesoamericanist.
Hey.
I took a Mesoamerican archaeology class at Auburn
mm-hmm.
and fell in love with the Maya culture. And when I got into my master's program, I told my advisor that I wanted to study Maya teeth. And she happened to do her dissertation on Maya teeth. And so it was a great fit for me, right? And then I found a program. And at the time, the professor was at Ole Miss, or the University of Mississippi. And he was leading bioarchaeological investigations down in Belize.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined him.
Yeah.
And that first year, I didn't excavate any human remains. We hiked 4 miles into our site every day through knee-deep mud to excavate architecture.
Oh, my.
Yeah. It was fun. I excavated an A group, which is the elite structure within this large Maya site called Tipan.
Okay.
And it was miserable. It was miserable. This program, many of, you know, aspiring archaeologists went into and took the field school mm-hmm. and then decided not to become archaeologists because of it.
Yeah, that's kind of what field schools are for sometimes.
Yes, yes, it's to weed out folks. And then I was like, I hate this so much, I want to do it again next year.
That's right.
And then I went back.
Yeah.
And but it was good. I mean, it was a learning experience for sure. learning how to deal with myself, mm-hmm. right? And being able to put myself through some very austere environments.
Yeah.
To actually find some pleasure in excavating architecture and rocks and working in the rain and with bugs and these things called botflies
for yeah.
our the listeners.
Just describe a botfly so we can get the full picture here.
Yes. They're wonderful little creatures. So the mosquitoes down in Central America and other places around the world carry the larva of this other type of fly. And when the mosquito bites you, the larva comes off of the mosquito and then buries into your skin. And then it grows and you have your own baby botfly that grows in your body. Mm-hmm. And it can be anywhere. I've killed a couple in heads and arms and backs. You know, it's kind of wherever they bite you. And, you know, if your mosquito bite doesn't go away in a couple of days and it starts to start oozing and pussing and stuff, you have a botfly. And then eventually the larva grows bigger and bigger and creates this little blowhole that it eats away at your skin and flesh and, like, you know, pushes it out until you kill it. Yeah. And it was really funny because I'm a Southern woman and Southern women keep their toes painted in the summer. And so to my first trip to Belize, I brought maybe 3 or 4 different nail colors and clear polish, and everyone made fun of me until we figured out that my clear nail polish was a wonderful botfly killer.
Really?
Yes.
You like paint over the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it suffocates them because it closes up their blowhole, and that's how you kill them.
That makes sense.
And so then I was everybody's friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all wanted my fingernail polish, and we had little pink and purple and blue dots all over people because everyone was just eaten alive.
That is a good pro tip right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't really get into modern politics or religion much on this show. Maybe prehistoric or ancient modern politics or religion, but not modern. However, anybody that believes in intelligent design and then hears that, you know, this creature basically evolved to live inside of another creature and then develop inside of yet another one. And that's how it's, I mean, who would make that a reality if they had a choice, right?
I have no idea. And you could actually, when you walk by the cows and horses and stuff at some of the farms that we'd walk past, you could see their little raised things with their little botflies. And that's really where they come from, is that on the livestock and stuff, they have them really bad. But I was smart enough to bring long sleeves and long pants and wear a bandana in my hair so they couldn't get caught in my hair.
Yeah.
And so I didn't get one.
This is archaeology, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just about the artifacts.
But
that's one thing you learn, I would say, relatively quickly as an archaeologist. My first couple field seasons, to be honest, I had short sleeve shirts.
Mm-mm.
You always wear long pants. That seems like a no-brainer, although some people show up in shorts. You know, they do. We had someone on a project in Southeast United States, and I can't fault her for this because no one trains people properly for CRM archaeology or field archaeology. You might do a field school, but you kind of treat that as a one-off until you really get used to it. And, you know, you're probably told what to bring and things like that, but we had a person show up on site, and she had, like, super tight, fancy jeans on, tennis shoes, and the jeans didn't even come all the way down, and she had short socks on so we could see her ankles. We're like, those are going to be cut up. And like this totally inappropriate top for working where we were working. Let me just put it that way. But like full makeup and everything too, which whatever, wear full makeup. I mean, I don't care, but
you know.
Yeah, you're probably going to, I mean, the makeup that most people prefer to wear is 100% DEET and sunscreen, right? So,
yes.
You know,
with whatever the oxide is.
Exactly. So anyway, you just learn what to wear, and long sleeve, even out here in the desert. I was just working in Southern California, Nevada, and Arizona, you know, below sea level in 100-degree temperatures a month ago, and you wear long sleeves. And
Absolutely.
We had a couple guys on the crew wearing short sleeve shirts, and I'm like, you are going to – and some of our Native American monitors who weren't so used to field work were also wearing short sleeve shirts, and I'm like, you guys are going to be hot. You know, and you're damaging your skin, you know.
Yeah, I have a different, like, layering system depending on where I am.
Right.
In the jungle, I would wear a cotton layer because they stayed wet and kept me cooler.
Nice.
But out here, I wear a technical underlayer to where, like, it kind of wicks away the stuff in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it depends on where I am. I have my different layers, but always long sleeves.
Yeah.
Just the other day, I was out in the Jackson, California area doing some surveying, and it was just full of poison oak. And, you know, I have long sleeves on, and I had gloves on, and only my little fingertips were showing.
Yeah.
And I can walk through this poison oak, and it's okay. I'm not going to be affected because I'm completely covered.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any problems. So it's always, no matter where you are and what you're doing, wear long sleeves.
Yes. And something I discovered only about 4 years ago, and I'm very sad that I only discovered it that long ago. I always wore gloves. Even in the summertime, I always wore gloves. But I discovered, because a colleague of mine wore them, and I went and bought the exact same pair, sun gloves with the fingerless. Oh, my God, they're so amazing. They keep your hands actually kind of cool. And then you've got protective gloves on because you're always grabbing weird things out in the field.
Yep.
But then your fingerless, you know, I'm all digital on the archaeology, and it allows you to do different things.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's they're just great.
Yeah, that's what I wear, too. They're like little glacier sun gloves.
Yes. I think that's the only people making them, because I've seen other people wearing them, those white ones.
Mine are some type of like snake skin or something pattern.
Nice.
I sold them for my husband. He's a big mountaineer guy. And I was like, ooh, these look wonderful for the field.
But I think it's that Glacier brand or whatever.
Yeah.
They're the only ones that I've ever seen. Yeah.
Yep.
You buy them at like REI. And
yep, that's exactly what I wear.
Totally. And, you know, they're only about $20, too. They're super cheap because there's nothing to them. They're very thin. I actually need a new pair. Mine are trashed. I need to buy a new pair. But anyway, getting off topic, back to Belize. What you mentioned architecture, you know, finding something. What does this stuff look like? People might be thinking of Mayan pyramids and step pyramids and things like that, which may be what you found. But what are the common things that you would find down there?
So when you do see these pyramids and such like that, that are just brick or limestone bricks, basically, these guys have been reconstructed, and it's called consolidation. In Belize in particular, they will consolidate all of the sites into where they will reconstruct them to where they what their original shape and size and design would have been. But when you walk up on them on a site that's unexcavated or unconsolidated, they look like hills in the jungle. So you're walking along and you're in Belize, and there are some mountains in Belize, but then you walk up in these like huge hills that are just completely covered in vegetation, and then you see like weird little limestone, cut limestone bricks sticking out of them. I did pull a really big Indiana Jones trick one time and grabbed a vine and swung off of one.
Nice.
I felt like, woo, yeah, look at me, Dr. Jones. But that's about as far as my Indiana Jones trips have been.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you can't really see what's going on if you just walk up on it.
Yeah.
An everyday person, you have to really go out there with someone who's been working in this particular area for a while to point out, like, here is this one particular structure. This is the main elite structure. This is the inside of the temple, so this would have been a private entrance, and so we uncovered stairs that were restricting the entrance into this kind of lowered space that would have been a living space, and then walls that kind of went up and also restricted access and stuff. We were excavating on the very, very top of the highest mountain or hill in there.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if there's any what some of the, aside from just sheer experience, I mean, these people know what they're looking for when they go down time and time again, but is it just kind of the hill formations? I've never been to Belize. Is it a hilly area? If you do see some hills, chances are there are structures, or is there indicative vegetation or what it looks like that maybe is unique to that?
You know what? It's a little bit of both. So there's a lot of agricultural land. And if you're walking through a field and you see a big hill, just like down south, like that's going to be going to be a man-made mound.
Right.
But if you're walking through the jungle, it depends on what part of the country you're in, because there are the Maya Mountains that kind of run through Belize. And then they have a pine ridge that kind of runs off of those guys. So you can be in the foothills of these mountains. But if you're walking through the jungle, most of it's pretty flat.
Yeah.
So if you're going to walk up on some type of berm, or just like we do out here or in the Sierras, when you walk up on this weird berm and you're like, this is not natural. This looks like a man-made berm. Oh, it's a placer mining site. It's kind of the same thing in Belize too, but they're just a lot bigger.
Right. Okay. And what is survey? Is it really just walking around trying to find some of these structure-like things, or are you doing any shovel testing, looking for artifacts on the surface?
No.
Because there wouldn't be anything on the surface, would there?
There is stuff on the surface.
Is there really?
Absolutely.
The jungle didn't eat it all?
Not all of it, no.
Yeah.
There is some surface stuff, if you can see underneath the duff. But most of it is you are just walking through the jungle with your GPS or surveying. We'll set up a totals instrument station and do some surveys and spread out and take survey of the land and get some geo points and put it back in the computer and see what they look like.
Okay.
And kind of do an assessment that way. But most of the sites down in Belize, these archaeologists who have been working there for years and years just hike through the jungle. Mm-hmm. They actually did LIDAR across the entire country now. And so they have that, which is really, really neat. So nowadays it's more about ground truthing, the LIDAR.
Man.
So
that was my exact next question, because I was wondering if LIDAR was almost a requirement to go out there beforehand, because it's so good at seeing through the jungle. And for people that don't know, they fly LIDAR on actual airplanes, although there are some drone-sized LIDAR units out there now.
Ooh.
They're super expensive.
I can imagine.
But they're cheaper than an airplane.
Fancy that.
Yeah. But there's drone-sized LIDAR, and LIDAR is light detection and ranging, I think, is what LIDAR stands for. And it's basically a unit that scans the surface, and I'm not going to get into the science because I can't explain it very well. It
shoots little lasers down.
Yeah. But it gets through the vegetation and shows you the surface. And I mean, it's still a little bit lumpy, but it at least shows you the surface. And you're like, that looks like it could be something. That way you don't have to, you know, hack your way through the jungle and get lost and find these different areas. You can just, like you said, ground truth the hits.
Yeah. So they've been ground truthing a lot of the Chiltoons, the underground cave sites, and then some of the other mound sites and stuff like that, the structures that just kind of look like hills. And, you know, in Belize, there was a study not too long ago, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes, you know, the LIDAR, it was a false positive.
Sure.
And so that happened.
It's
so
not
this
perfect.
This is why ground truthing is very important. Yeah. And you can't just look at the LIDAR and be like, this is a gigantic Maya site. But it did, when they did the LIDAR over Tikal, which is the big famous site in Guatemala, it showed the expansiveness of Tikal. I mean, it just goes out for miles and miles and miles from the city center.
Yeah. So speaking of false positives, you and your circle must have talked about that kid a few years ago that did the research project or whatever, and he was like, I found a new Maya site.
And they're like, no.
Yeah. Get I don't know how familiar you are with that, but if you have the ability to give a little background on that.
I don't remember it exactly, but he did claim. And the thing about finding new Maya sites is a little bit derogatory towards the indigenous people who actually live there.
Right. They're still Maya people.
Yeah, they're still Maya people. The Mayans are still alive. And most of them actually know about these sites because they've been going through these jungles their entire life, hunting and gathering. Still. And so to say that you discovered a new Maya site that no one knows about.
Somebody knows about it.
Yes, somebody knows about it. Whether they are an academic scholar or just a local, someone knows.
Yeah. That's not unlike some of the big structures in, say, the Southwest and things like that. There's still very many Native Americans that live down there, and they probably are aware of some of that stuff, and for good reason they're not telling anyone about it. Then we find it and discover it. You know, I'm doing air quotes over here. I realize I'm on radio. And they're like, oh, yeah, that, you know. So
you found it.
Yeah.
Yay.
So, hey, real quick, I want to describe the difference because a lot of people screw this up. It's like Neanderthal and Neanderthal. Explain the difference between Maya and Mayan, because a lot of people just say Mayan sites. Why is that wrong?
Mayan, with an N, references the people in the language only.
Okay.
Everything else is Maya.
Okay.
So architecture or archaeology or an artifact or a building, it's all Maya.
Yeah, I know when people hear the difference, they think it's the difference between singular and plural.
Nope.
Yeah.
Mayan refers to language and people. So they speak Mayan or a dialect of Mayan, or they are Mayan people. Otherwise,
so there is no singular or plural for that word. It refers to all the things. Yeah.
Well, yes, you can say Mayas.
Oh,
artifact,
I suppose you can.
But it's like that's kind of a weird, it doesn't really work out for you.
And
you can, but Mayans, more than one Mayan person, that works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Little terminology there. And also, you mentioned Guatemala and Belize so far. How far can you think off the top of your head? How far does the Maya civilization reach, I guess Mayan civilization reach in modern country terms?
Oh, in modern country terms, they're in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, mostly all of Central America, up until like the northern Panama, anywhere between the north of Panama up to Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you get into northwest Mexico, so the Mexico Valley, where we're actually Mexico City and up into where Mexico meets the states, that turns into a different territory and not necessarily Maya. That's more, you know, Aztec and Olmec territory on the coast, and Mixtec territory. Mm-hmm. And the Maya in Mexico were closer to Guatemala area and then in the Yucatan.
Okay. Okay. Nice. So why didn't you continue with Maya archaeology?
It's a hard field to continue with if you're not an academic. Yeah. Most of the individuals who do archaeology in Belize and Mexico and Guatemala are all academics. Mm-hmm. It's funding issues. Like, you have to get grants.
It's fairly well saturated, too, isn't it? There's a lot of people that want to do Belizean archaeology specifically.
Mayanists are a dime a dozen.
Yeah, kind of like Egyptologists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something you find out later on down the line. And so, yeah, we're a dime a dozen. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people studying this, but there's also a good reason for that. Not only is it, I mean, we painted a picture to start out. It's not like the best place to go visit from like a walking through the jungle standpoint. That being said, it's really cool and unique. I mean, I've never been down there, but I've seen, you know, plenty of stuff about it. And I mean, what is attracting so many people there, do you think? Is there just so many more questions that we need answered that we don't have answers to? Or what's the big attraction, do you think?
That's a good question. So what is the big attraction? For me, it was, you know, the gander, the large and extravagant culture.
Mm-hmm.
Much like Egypt. Mm-hmm. The Maya built these large temples and they didn't have draft animals to do it. Mm-hmm. And they have these really complex social systems going on and all of these really neat artifacts. And so I always just wanted to go down there and investigate. And I had all these questions about diet. I've always been interested in food.
Mm-hmm.
My family down south used to own restaurants, barbecue restaurants a lot. So food has always been a big part of my culture.
Yeah.
And so I had all these questions about how they ate and what they ate and who ate what.
Yeah.
And how it affected their health and in general, their oral health. So that was kind of my draw towards it is I want to know what people eat and
sure.
I want to know what kind of food you're eating now. So in order to do that, I have to go down there and eat all kinds of delicious Belizean dishes, right?
Yeah.
And Maya dishes that are still replicated.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my draw to it. But really, I think a lot of people, it's, you know, the fantasy of it all.
What's your favorite Maya dish?
Oh, well, Maya dish. I'm not entirely sure if it's Maya or if it's Belizean, but my favorite Belizean dish is chimole, which is a black soup.
Okay.
It's made from a spice down there that I can't remember what it's called. And it is, it's basically like chicken and potatoes and eggs, and you kind of eat it over rice, but it's just, it's black. It's
sounds
pitch
delicious.
Black, and it's so good. And you eat it in the heat of the summer, and it's still delicious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably got roots in Maya culture, mm-hmm. just because if that's from local spices and things like that, the people still live there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
What language do the existing Mayan people speak? Or is it like a hybrid of Spanish that includes Spanish and something like that?
It depends on where you are, but there are multiple dialects of Mayan spoken nowadays. I know there's one, I can't recall their names correctly.
But they're not just all speaking Spanish.
No, they're not. A lot of people do speak both Spanish and an indigenous Maya language.
Okay, that's cool.
So there are about four or five different dialects of Mayan spoken in Mexico, Belize, and Guatemala, and Honduras and stuff.
It's really cool because one of the famous things to talk about is like Inspect Jared Diamond's book, talks about, what was it, Collapse? One of the big examples in that book was the collapse of the Maya civilization. And people are like, oh, they're gone. No more Maya civilization. You know, maybe they weren't calling themselves that anymore. But as far as a civilization goes, but they didn't exactly go away.
They didn't collapse. No. They reorganized.
Yeah.
And this is the big thing with academic archaeologists trying to negate this storyline that the collapse didn't, that there's no collapse. Like, one, they're still alive. And two, the larger cities, the Maya are notorious for kind of abandoning things. And if things aren't working out, they're not.
Cut bait and run.
Yeah, they're not really loyal to one person. They're loyal to whomever's going to help them.
Sure.
So if that person isn't really helping them, they're just going to pick up and go.
Yeah.
And go live in the jungle by themselves or something to this effect. And so they just reorganized and moved up from the Belizean Guatemalan area into the Yucatan during the post-classic period, which is mostly post-collapse. I mean, there was a lot of site abandonment. This is true. But this whole idea of this Maya collapse and what is happening, it's more of a reorganization.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's really cool to think about it that way. I feel like one of the things we do as archaeologists, not just CRM, but really archaeology as a whole, is somehow, some way, some idea about a thing gets into popular culture, and then we just spend the rest of our careers trying to fight it and change the narrative, which is so hard to do.
What was when the Mayan calendar ended? What was that? Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah, because the whole world was going to end, right?
Yeah, a couple of years back, that was the big pain for Mayanists to be like, no, the world's not ending. This has happened multiple times. Their calendar is cyclic. It's just going to roll over.
Right.
We're going into a new cocktoon. Fancy this. Like, nothing's happening.
I mean, the current calendar we use ends every year, so we don't freak out about that, do we? Except for it's 2000. That was the one time because all the computers were going to die.
Yes. I remember that.
Yeah. So
you may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Okay, so let's take this back to CRM archaeology a little bit, because I'm a CRM archaeologist, you're a CRM archaeologist, so let's talk about this a little bit. One of the things I talk about a lot on the Archaeotech podcast, I've talked about it on this program, is digital archaeology. Okay, so what are some of the technology things that Ganda, your company, or maybe just something you've used in the past? I don't know if you've always worked for Ganda since you got your PhD, but some of the things you've used in the past. What are some of the digital archaeology ways that may have maybe different from when people got into this 10 years ago that you guys are using now? Not just tablets and things like that, but, you know, other stuff. Where are you guys going? Are you thinking about different things?
Oh, 10 years ago. So 10 years ago.
Because that's how fast things are changing.
Yeah, this is true. 10 years ago, I was a lone little end of my undergraduate, beginning of my master's program.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't privy to all of the fancy technologies that were the, you know, what you could choose from. I was just told, here, you do this.
Yes.
But nowadays, we actually use a app on our phones for GIS, Art Collector, which is really great. You can put it on any of your phones in the field and download maps offline and then record everything instead of having to send out expensive Trimble units with all of your field techs, especially if you have a lot of field techs.
Mm-hmm.
They can put it on their own phone, and that's been a wonderful, wonderful thing. And you sync and it automatically comes back to our office live. We are trying to move into digital paper, so paperless type thing.
Yeah.
We're still looking at
I've never heard it called digital paper before.
Digital paper.
That's a good one. I like that, actually.
I mean, it's paper. It's digital. Maybe.
Yeah, kind of.
We're slowly trying to figure out how that would work best for us and our field work and what we do. It would be lovely if I didn't have to type up forms that come in from the field.
Yeah.
You know, field forms are in field recordings in your notebook and stuff like that are part of archaeology, and everyone has these little write in the rain waterproof notebooks that you record everything in. But if I could just put it right into my iPad, my goodness, and save myself a step, that would be wonderful. I do believe within the next year or two that will be huge for almost all of CRM. If you're going places, you're going to be digital.
It helps too, because a lot of people don't realize something we have in this field called the curation problem, which is because we have to, I mean, legally in some cases, depending on the agency you're working for, all those little field notebooks and your paper forms and things like that, once you type them into a Word document, a database, whatever you're doing, you still have to keep it.
Yep.
Like, you can't get rid of that stuff.
Yep.
You know, they have to be curated in a box sitting on a shelf, and someone has to pay for that, you know, at $250 a year or whatever they're going to do. And that's going to go into the project budget and then ongoing budget for the company or whoever's in charge of doing this, right? And there simply just isn't enough shelf space for all this stuff.
It's also stuff. Like, there's lots of stuff.
Yeah.
We already get, we collect things in certain situations. And so that becomes stuff on a shelf, too. And so our papers just are extra stuff.
I know. And those things are more important to keep, you know, the artifacts and things like that. We keep those because, you know, different methods of analysis and things like that come along down the line. I think of all the things that come out almost, you know, almost monthly, if not weekly, where somebody was going through an old collection and realized, oh, that's not this, that's actually this. Mm-hmm. You know, they reanalyze it or they use some new technique to analyze it. you know.
Both my thesis and dissertation were on collections. I didn't excavate or go out and find new things. It was on existing collections because I'm very much about this reuse, even in archaeology, to look at it through a different lens or try to answer a different question that hasn't been answered with a collection that's previously been excavated. It was actually excavated before I was born.
mine was actually pre-existing as well, and it was excavated 2 years after I was born.
Oh, fancy!
So yeah, that was fun. It was an old it was a landscape in Georgia, and they filled it in with a lake, as they were doing, to make a reservoir. And I think half the PhDs in Georgia archaeology were handed out on that project because the University of Georgia was the one managing it.
What was the site?
It was the site is called 9PM201. It's in Putnam County, Georgia, and it was Lake Oconee.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There were hundreds of sites under Lake Oconee.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this was a big site that dated back about 9,000 years ago. And it had this pottery on it. And I'm forgetting the name of the pattern. But it was very unique because they hadn't found much of it elsewhere. And then when I was basically just handed this, I told my advisor, I was like, listen, I want to work on something old. And the nature of my program, we kind of had to work on. We didn't have time to go out and do fresh field work, right? Mm-hmm. So he said, there's all these Lake Oconee sites, and I've got one I think you're going to like. And basically, they excavated the whole thing. So I had their site maps, and I had all the artifacts. They weren't really cataloged. They were put into bags and put into boxes. Mm-hmm. And I had 45 boxes of artifacts.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah, 45. I'll never forget that number because I know where in the site files room and where the artifacts were. Oh, my God. I knew exactly how to
your
get to that stuff.
Your wall of boxes.
It was like two walls of boxes. It was so terrible. And but I went through all that stuff over the course of my master's degree and just pulled it all out, cleaned it, reanalyzed it, did all that stuff, and found – I think it was somewhere around three or four times the amount of that typical stamp type of pottery than had ever been found before.
Wow.
And I didn't find it. It was in that collection and nobody knew about it.
That's so neat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So hitting these old collections is pretty great. But, you know, the other cool thing is I had their field notes too. And that's a very big concern for digital archaeology is having our – because there's a lot of people that have been doing this for 30, 40 years that are like, well, we tried digital in the 80s and it didn't work because we couldn't read those files because the disk corrupted or we used, you know, some weird program that we can't access anymore. But we have standards now. You know, PDF and high-level PDFs are actually a national, if not global, standard for data.
Yes.
And we're going to be able to read those for a long time. You know, CSV files are human readable and you'll be able to read those for a long time. And those are mistakes that we had to learn. But we learned them, you know?
And now we should use them.
And now we should use them,
yeah,
right.
I had the same thing with my dissertation collection. It's my dissertation and my master's was on a site called Tipu, which is on the Belizean and Guatemalan border. Mm-hmm. It was a Spanish mission site.
Yeah.
And so it was previously occupied before the Spanish got there, but also kind of restructured when they came. And they built a Visita church. Mm-hmm. And there were about 600 individuals buried in a Christian manor around and inside this church. And so we had all of the original 1980s burial sketches and field notes and all of these things that I was also digitizing, and me and my colleagues were digitizing as we were starting to do research on this. My advisor at Southern Miss actually happened to excavate this site. She was a field student on this site. And eventually she now has the collection as the curator for it. But at one point during my summers, we all traveled up to upstate New York at Plattsburgh, where the collection was kept from the 80s until about 2012. And I drove a U-Haul from upstate New York to the coast of Mississippi with 600 plus skeletons in the back of it, praying that I wouldn't get pulled over and ask what you got in there.
Yeah.
It was like, I have paperwork.
Yeah. It's a good thing you didn't go to California.
I know, right?
You know, the fruit stand people would have got you.
They would have got me. And there would have been a lot of questions.
A lot of questions.
Sorry, ma'am, but do you know you have human remains back here?
Nice. Nice. I've been to Plattsburgh. Had to stay there one night when I was working in Vermont.
It's lovely, isn't
it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, all the leaf peepers came into town and took up all the hotel rooms. That's what they called them up there, the people that came in for the fall colors change.
Oh,
the locals called them leaf peepers.
Leaf peepers.
Yeah. We were on a long project, and we had the hotel rooms booked out, except for there was like two weekends where they'd been booked for a year. And we had to go to Plattsburgh and then commute over. Yeah.
So you were in Burlington?
Yeah, we were in Burlington. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very nice area.
It is.
To do archaeology. Yeah. So what's going on with the site that you worked on now? Are people continuing to do stuff with it?
No, it hasn't been excavated since the excavations in the 80s were pretty large scale. I mean, they mm-hmm. excavated 600 plus skeletons, and there was one small investigation in the 90s. It was 2002 that put some small test units, so little 50 by 50 holes and one by ones in a couple of very distinct areas to mm-hmm. try to find more of the colonial architecture.
Okay.
But nothing's really been done since then. And there's a whole pre-contact component to this site that I've always been interested in trying to discover a little bit more and do a little bit more investigations. There has to be some more pre-contact human remains there because mm-hmm. most of the ones that were from the cemetery are post-contact.
Yeah.
There hasn't really been much. It's a farmland. There are some cows that live on it. The church structure is still there. They rebuilt it, and I've gone out and I got to see it, actually. Someone cut down the grass because it was, you know, probably almost over my head to waist-high grass all around it.
Yeah.
And so a local friend went out and chopped me a path and chopped grass all the way around the structure so I could see it and stuff. So that was really, really cool experience to be able to actually see my dissertation site.
Those locals are like surgeons with a machete, aren't
they? Oh my goodness. Oh man. They grow up with them.
Right.
So,
they have
you know,
to.
Yeah.
If you don't keep the jungle back, it'll take you down pretty quick.
Yes, it will. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that you said something that made me think of a question I've actually never thought of before. And I've never been down there, but I've done a lot of reading and things like that. And you mentioned colonial presence.
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been, that you can recall, have you read anything or seen anything about reuse of some of the old Maya sites, either by like ancestor or descendant populations or colonial reuse, you know, like maybe rebuilding something that was already had a massive stone foundation and then using it for colonial purposes? I never even thought about that. I mean, they're like right there.
So the Maya are pretty notorious about reusing their structures.
Their own stuff.
Almost all of the structures will have various building layers, and you are able to actually see these layers in your excavation. They would repaint them with plaster very often. As soon as the plaster started to fade, or the color on the plaster would start to fade, they'd redo the plaster and repaint it.
Mm-hmm.
So they naturally rebuilt on top of their own architecture.
They had no religious taboos against using it. I mean, they'd abandon it and come right back to it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And for modern day use, a lot of locals still use cave sites. And so there are a lot of cave sites down there, and they are ritual sites. And now, you know, they might be more Catholic in nature to their rituals that they are performing in these cave sites. But they still actually use the caves. And I worked in a site in Mexico on a cave, and right before the entrance to where we were working, there's this little kind of cove that had a cross and a bunch of candles and some other ritual items where the locals would hike up the hill, and this is 400 steps up to these caves, and perform their rituals.
That's awesome.
Yeah. At a really early formative Mexican site.
Okay. All right. Well, we are nearing the end of the program. I want to ask you right now. So you're in CRM archaeology. You're here in Carson City, Nevada. You've got a PhD. Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Oh, man. What a question. Where do I see myself in 10 years?
I mean, do you want to own a CRM firm? Do you want to progress up there? Do you want
you
to
know
go?
What? Right now, know? I really enjoy working for my company. I have a wonderful relationship with my coworkers, and my boss is actually super supportive and very encouraging and trusting. And so I am enjoying my current position in my at Ganda.
Yeah.
And you know, where I'll go in the few years, we'll kind of see where it takes me from here. I'm not against doing environmental compliance for a while.
Sure.
I don't particularly want to go into academia. We love the Sierras, so we would love to stay here, but we don't own a home, and my husband and I are kind of
flexible.
We're ramblers, you know. Last year we lived in Japan, and
nice.
You know, he and I, this is actually the Reno Tahoe area, is the only area I've lived in more than 3 years besides my childhood home.
Yeah
And for my husband too, like we move a lot. We like to meet new people and live in new places, and so you know, where we'll be in 10 years, who knows?
It's so funny. My wife and I are kind of the same way. We've been all over the place because of archaeology, but even before that, I was all over the place. And this is the longest I've been in a single location in a really long time since I left Seattle. And I don't know what it is about here. We just like it. We like the desert. We like the mountains.
Yep.
You know, we bought a house in December, and it was the first house I bought. It's only the second house I ever bought. And the last one was in Oklahoma in 1997.
Wow.
So, yeah, and I only owned it for 2 years, right? Yeah. So...
My husband was a Marine for a long time, so he traveled a lot, and I've traveled all over the world, and so we have dreams of going and living in Europe and living abroad again. We really enjoyed living outside of the United States for a while, and so we'd like to go elsewhere and see, you know, what we can get into.
There you go. Well, I was in the Navy. I don't think I can be in a room with your husband because, you know, they don't like having their supervisors around.
Oh, I'm just telling you. You mean his water taxi?
His water taxi. Oh, so many jokes. So many jokes. Yes. All right. Well, thank you, Amanda, for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming down here. And if you're listening to this live and you want to hear it again, it will be on the Archaeology Podcast Network at arcpodnet.com/archaeology. I've had to think about it for a second. We've got so many forward slashes. There's lots of shows over there. And new shows coming on down the line. And if you are listening to this and you're an archaeologist and you want to come on the show, then email me, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, and we'll make that happen. For now, thanks for listening to the show. Again, my name is Chris Webster, and I won't be here next week if you're listening to this live because I'm doing some digital archaeology in Southern California, but I will be back the following week with more great topics. So thank you for listening. Again, thank you, Amanda, for coming on.
Thank you.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.